All right. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. It's been a while since I've been on Channel 9.
It has.
Well, the countdown shows, of course, but...
Yeah, but I just want to say, in this case,
yeah. There
is no timer. And if there was, we'd break it right now.
So you do realize that if we start talking about animation, I am going to have to bring timer and timers into this conversation.
That's fine. Virtual timers are good.
You just don't want spring-loaded timers.
No, I don't want spring-loaded timers cutting things off.
Fair enough, my man.
The last time we talked to you, actually, PBC08,
that's right, it was.
You wrote a very interesting algorithm for, essentially a genetic algorithm for scheduling purposes.
Correct.
So, and you've also since then written some very cool plugins for Adobe Illustrator to go to, say, XAML.
Correct.
You've done some other stuff. First of all, you're Mike Swanson.
I am Mike Swanson.
All right. People know you on Channel 9. You're a director, and you're responsible for keynotes at events and various other things.
Content sessions. My team works on that, and I'm on the core team, so... Mix, PDC, TechEd, North America, and Europe. We've got both those coming up soon. So,
cool. And good stuff. Of course, in the background, you were a developer.
Yeah, that's right. My history is as a developer. A little right. IT pro in there, but mostly developer.
Right on.
Yeah.
So, what have you done?
What have I done?
What are you
most
working
recently,
on?
What
so
have
far?
I up to?
I see those Facebook,
the cryptic posts.
Yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, so it's an after hours thing, right? Because putting on events is a big deal. But basically, I took the work that you were just referring to that we did on the Illustrator to XAML exporter, which I think is 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that.
Wow.
It's been a long time. But basically, that was a plugin that was built using the Adobe Illustrator SDK. Matter of fact, I believe there's a session probably still up on Channel 9.
I'm sure there is.
About the building of that. Okay. But basically, taking that SDK, building a plugin that works inside of Adobe Illustrator, and will allow you to take the artwork that you've drawn in Adobe Illustrator and export it to XAML, which initially had support for, I think we called it Avalon at the time, but became Windows Presentation Foundation, WPF. And then a modification of that over some years turned it into a Silverlight exporter as well.
Excellent.
So the idea was take your artwork, get it out into WPF or Silverlight. And at the time, there weren't really many tools to do that. Right? We hadn't released our tools yet as a company, and this was really just a bridge to get people who spent more time in Illustrator or maybe had assets in Illustrator, because Illustrator opens a lot of other formats too, and get that over into WPF or Silverlight just so that you could use it in your apps.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And so
this.
Yes.
I got to give some credit to our buddy Thomas Lewis down the hall here for evangelizing this thing in HTML5 called a canvas.
Okay.
Right. And as we talked at lunch, he got me excited about what HTML5 was bringing to the table with canvas. So I started to dig in and explore a little bit. And when I wanted to start playing around with it, one of the things I found very quickly felt a lot like the old days of when we were working with XAML is there's no tooling really to do any, I'll just say, serious work with canvas yet because it's pretty early. And a little light bulb went off, and I said, you know what, I could probably wake up this plugin and make a version that would work with the canvas specification. So that's what I've been doing for the last 4 months, I'd say.
Wow.
And you're talking to me about a week before we release this thing. So
yes.
It's exciting.
Excellent, man. And so let's talk a little bit about, I mean, mainly what we're going to do here is sort of give us a demo.
Yeah.
But then we really want, I want to kind of geek out on what you did, because you wrote, C++, you have to in some sense.
That's right.
Deal with the Adobe plugin model.
Correct.
But then again, you got to put some, you got to move things around at a very low level. But also, I'm very interested in how you went from an image to JavaScript.
Because
in some sense, JavaScript is driving the browser to paint the canvas.
That's right. That's right.
So, and I've seen, in all honesty and transparency, this is Channel 9.
Yeah.
You showed me a demo of this, I think, 2 months ago.
That's probably right.
So, but I think I'd like to see it 2 months later.
Yeah, yeah. And before we show the demo, the thing that might be helpful to people is to understand Canvas.
Actually, yes.
I'll draw in a minute, but I want people to understand Canvas because, I'm still relatively new to Canvas, even though I've been immersed in it.
Yeah.
And you hear about all these new things, SVG, been around for a while. Illustrator actually has exported SVG, and they just came out with their own add-in pack that makes it even better for HTML5. So you've got SVG out there. You hear about Canvas.
Mm-hmm.
How does that relate to bitmap images, and why would I use one over the other? And I don't know that we know all the answers yet, but you can kind of, at a high level, understand. We all know what a bitmap image is, right? A PNG image, a GIF image, a JPEG image is just a rectangle of pixels that gets splatted out on the screen. That's it. Nice and simple, easy to do. We've used them for years. SVG is a vector-based format that has been, it's kind of like XAML, actually. If you look at XAML and you look at what's in SVG, they're very similar. The syntax is different, but they're both XML-based, and they describe this object model. It's called a retained graphics mode, meaning that when you tell it what you want it to draw, you build up this object model, and it retains it in memory so that if it ever needs to repaint or redraw it, it knows where the circle is, it knows where the square is, and so on. Mm. And it's all vector-based, so you can rotate it, move it, and it maintains full fidelity.
Excellent.
Canvas is really just a bitmap surface. So it's, again, a rectangle of pixels. Hmm. And the idea is that you issue drawing commands to it to paint on that canvas. And matter of fact, if your mental model is painting, that's actually a good way to think about it. Because you issue commands that deal with vectors, like draw a circle or draw a Bezier curve, but as soon as you've drawn it, it's now just pixels on a canvas, so to speak. So you can't go back and say, well, I want to move it. You actually have to erase the canvas, or at least erase a portion of the canvas, and redraw it after you've done whatever transformations you want. So it's much lower level, mm-hmm. but it allows you to do some things that you might not do with SVG. It's closer to the metal. Mm-hmm. You can do games, not that you couldn't do them in SVG, mm-hmm. but canvas lends itself to some things. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see when we do this demo is, one of my fears, actually, is that this tool makes it look like it's so easy to use Canvas that you might use Canvas for the wrong reasons.
Interesting.
But we're all learning. We're all figuring it out. The good news is now there's a little bit of tooling for Canvas, and we don't have to look at all these samples on the web that just have squares and smiley faces, essentially, because that's all you can create without a drawing tool.
Excellent.
So you ready for a demo?
I'm ready for a demo.
Let's switch seats here.
Absolutely.
All right. Sneak around here. Across my beautiful office.
Now there's that famous painting from the Vista days.
The photo from Vista, yeah. Taken
photo
at the
from
Ernest,
Vista.
Ernest Hemingway's house down in Key West.
Awesome.
Awesome, yeah.
Now listen, is it still in Windows 7? Because 95% of Vista is.
It's not in Windows 7, but the Windows 7 team did just release a feature pack that has some of my photos in it. So
excellent.
Completely separate project.
Yes.
All right, so tell you what. Let me unplug this so I get that interference off the screen. Okay. So I'm running Adobe Illustrator CS5. This is on PC.
All right.
But the plugin actually works on a Mac as well. So if you've got Adobe Illustrator on your Mac, it'll work there. CS3, CS4, or CS5 on both platforms.
Okay.
So the idea, there's really two kind of pieces of functionality. And let me just start out by opening a sample artwork that ships with Illustrator.
Nice.
And for those of you who aren't familiar with Illustrator, if I zoom in here, basically this is just a bunch of, you know, as I highlight it, you can see that Illustrator is showing me these vector paths and I can move them around easily, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a vector-based illustration package, even though you can also use bitmaps. So if I take this artwork, and let's say I wanted to use this in a canvas, and for some reason I wanted to retain its vectorness, right? Because in a lot of cases, to my earlier point, you'd just turn it into a bitmap and stick it down there.
Totally.
But if you're going to do something else with it, like maybe it's a game character that you need to move around, mm-hmm. you can simply pull down the File menu, choose Export. The plugin adds a new format to the long list of formats called Canvas.
Okay.
I'm just going to stick it in my temp folder. Hit Enter. It's going to export pretty quickly, and then it pops it up in whatever browser you've associated with HTML. In my case, I'm running 99 beta here.
Nice.
And what we get here is basically what we saw in the artwork over here in Illustrator. So
absolutely.
If you compare them side by side, I'm zoomed in on Illustrator, which is why it looks a little bigger, but it's basically the same thing. But if I look at the code behind, so if I view source, and I've hooked up VS 2010 to view source here, this is basically a very simple HTML5 document. And a couple things here is there's an initialization function that basically gets a reference to that canvas element on the page, and then kind of parties on and just draws lines, draws Beziers. And if I scroll through this, you'll see why I would probably never really do this. This goes on and on and on and on forever because it's very complex artwork, right?
Sure.
But you'll notice how fast it drew that to the screen.
Excellent.
So it's a good acid test, but it's probably not a practical test of what you do. And the idea for this plugin isn't that you export and then you're done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tool in your workflow.
Sure.
But if you're going to create kind of that game character or that element of a larger app, you'd create the element, and then you'd probably copy some of this code and paste it into your own code.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the goals of writing the plugin, the first principle was really respect the artwork.
Sure.
Right? Make it look like what the artist intended.
Yep.
Otherwise, what are you doing in Illustrator?
Yep.
The second thing was make it programmable. So the expectation is that you're not just going to stop when you've exported, that you're going to rip out pieces and put it in your own code.
Absolutely.
So a lot of decisions about how it formats the code were based on the fact that the code is not going to live here long. It's going to move somewhere else.
Interesting. Now, I mean, that brings up a really good point. I mean, in some sense, pretty much the only reason I'd want to use this tool would be to build sort of a mesh, if you will, or surface that I'm going to animate.
Correct.
To take advantage of what you know, you're going to be able to do on the GPU with IE9 and other browsers will, you know, write to DirectX too.
You bet.
GL, whatever. And really take advantage of having a designer draw this nice image or world that you then, as a developer, can come in and program against in JavaScript and DHTML.
Yep.
But you mentioned that Canvas will repaint everything.
Correct.
But it's doing it on the GPU, so it's going to be super fast.
That's right.
At least tonight.
That's right.
And
matter of fact,
other browsers.
Like, let me pop one up here. You've kind of bridged the discussion here to animation. Mm-hmm. Well, tell you what. Let me just do it here.
Let's animate this.
You should never really do this, but hey, we're walking on.
Hey, this is
cool. Channel 9 and it's raw, right? So we're going to give it a go. This is pretty complex. I don't know how well this will animate. And if you watch the tutorial that we'll ship up there, it'll explain what I'm about to do here. But essentially, you know, Illustrator doesn't understand animation. It's a static illustration package. So the challenge was, if we wanted to introduce animation, how do you do it, especially across all those versions? So I've kind of taken the simplistic method, which is if you just change your layer name, because Illustrator artwork's made up out of layers, and you change it to something that kind of looks like a JavaScript function, like let's call this test opening parentheses, closing parentheses, semicolon, right?
Wow.
And then I can insert some properties in the middle of those parentheses basically to tell it what I want it to do.
Okay.
That's how you kind of tell it what you want to happen. So in the middle here, I'm just going to say rotate direction colon CW, tells it clockwise. And I'm going to move the origin point, and then we can talk about what that means in a minute if you want, to its center, which basically is like sticking a pin in the center of this artwork, and when I rotate it, it's going to rotate around its center.
Excellent.
Whereas if the origin normally is up here and I stick a pin there and rotate it, it's going to make a really weird path.
Sure.
That's it. Click OK. And I'm just going to export the same thing like we just did before. So file export. Let me stick it in my temp folder again, so we'll overwrite the one that's there. And I don't know how well this will perform.
Oh.
Actually, right. Better than I thought it would perform, because it's drawing a lot of vectors.
Yes, on the GPU.
On the GPU in this case, because it's IE9.
Yeah.
And that's actually faster than I expected it to be.
Now, would there be you could go in and tweak the JavaScript to
that's
control the rig.
You can, or I can just go back into Illustrator and do it all there as well.
Very
like
nice.
Those little properties I added, there's many properties you can add. There's animation clocks and some other settings you can do.
Cool. So, hey,
you've
done some tutorials that people are going to be able
to
see to kind of get into how to use it and stuff like that.
Totally.
I want to dig into actually, you know, the magic just happened. We're watching it. Let's talk about how you made the magic happen.
You bet.
Let's get into some...
some code, huh?
Yeah, let's
algorithms,
go
what
let's
it took.
Into it. Yeah, let's jump down into the rabbit hole.
Want me to go to the whiteboard?
Yes.
All right, let's go.
Time for Michael on whiteboard.
Cool. I can tell I need to get a bigger office.
You do, man. You're a director. Why do you have such a small office?
You give the big offices to the people who do the real work. Isn't that how it works?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't go that far. So I'm just going to lift this up.
Yeah. So there's really two big sections to what the plugin does.
Okay.
There's artwork, right, which was the first example I gave, which is take whatever I can draw in Illustrator, which is a lot, right? I don't know how many versions, 13, 14 versions, if not more.
Wow.
Right? It's been a long lineage, and there's a lot of features built into Adobe Illustrator, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things in Illustrator that can be drawn that really have no direct equivalent over in the HTML5 Canvas spec, which is still pretty new.
Mm-hmm.
One simple example would be a Gaussian blur. So if you've got a drop shadow and you just want to blur it, you can do that easily in Illustrator, but once you get it over into Canvas, there's no such thing as a blur in Canvas. So what one thing the plugin will do is if it encounters a feature that isn't supported over there, it'll rasterize it. So it'll say, look, there's no way for me to redraw this natively, so I'm going to turn it into a ping file, essentially, with some alpha, do all the work on the Illustrator side, spit it out into a file, and then do the right HTML5 and JavaScript to basically paint that file in the right place at the right time.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the object model in Illustrator, I don't really know how I would draw it, but it's you know, there's an element, basically they call them artwork elements.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that at a layer, so when I started that document it had a layer built into it, by default it's got this artwork element, this handle I can grab kind of in the behind the scenes using their SDK. And then the artwork is a tree of elements, like you'd have a tree of elements in XML, there's really no difference, or like you might have a tree kind of any other structure that you'd have in programming. So if this is your layer, you may have another piece of artwork under here, right, that represents a path. So if you were to draw even a circle, for example, on the screen, there'll be an artwork handle that represents that path.
Okay.
There might be another handle on the page that represents more art that's what they call a placed image. Right? And a placed image is going to be a nice picture of Charles smiling or whatever the photo may be or the bitmap may be, because it works just as well with bitmaps. You can also group things. So you'll actually have an art that's really just a group. It doesn't draw anything itself, mm-hmm. but it's going to have more artwork elements that you want to treat as a package, right? So yeah. an illustrator, as I take this complex artwork and I want to move it around the page, I'm moving all of this around the page. But behind the scenes, it's retaining this in this tree form. And this is a retained model, kind of like when I was talking about SVG, where you build up the artwork, it sits in memory, and whenever you want to redraw it, move things around, you can do that.
Okay.
So the biggest first problem is how you get this retained graphics model into a painter model, where you're laying paint down.
Yes.
So in Illustrator, the higher the layer and the higher the artwork, it's going to be on top. Right? It's like stacking up sheets of paper. Whatever's on the top is going to show up on the top. But that's not how you paint. Right? I can't paint that way. I've got to paint starting at the bottom and then add paint, and then I should end up with what I end up with here. So a lot of the algorithm in the artwork or the plugin is I'll just say kind of crawls through the tree,
okay.
takes a bunch of notes, right? Like where am I going to need, on my reverse path here, which is what we're going to do, where am I going to need to make sure I set up clipping paths so I get the same visual behavior? Mm. Where am I going to have to change brush styles or brush strokes so that I get the same behavior? So it's not a one-to-one relationship at all. It's actually quite different. So there's a first pass that takes a bunch of notes, happens very quickly, just some internal structures, and then basically it turns around and walks the other direction, and using the notes it took the first time, it issues a bunch of, you know, it spits out JavaScript that draws it in the right order and does the right things to make it happen. Along the way, it actually has, I'll call it a simulation of the canvas. When you read to the canvas specification, the canvas has a drawing state. At any given time, it's got a state, which you can think of as a bag of properties, like what's the color of my fill? What's the color of my stroke? What's the shape of my stroke? What kind of joins do I have on lines? And so on. There's many of them. And whatever you set is retained, is remembered until you change it. So when you're issuing your own little JavaScript commands to draw to a canvas, you might say, change my fill color to red.
Yeah.
Until you change it again, it's red. So anything you fill or issue fill commands on will be red. And the original versions of this plugin were very naive. They didn't have this simulated canvas. So when it would walk back through the tree, if I saw a red thing here and another red thing here, it'd say, change the paint to red, draw the red thing. Change the paint to red, draw the red thing. In other words, you'd see a million paint changes that are unnecessary.
Okay.
And that's only one example. And there are many of these properties that you really don't need to change unless something changes. And the way to track that is there's a simulated version, kind of like an implementation of Canvas inside the plugin, that knows, oh, you know what? You already set it to red. You're trying to set it to red again? I'm ignoring you. I'm not going to spit out the JavaScript command. So the code that is output is probably as tight. It's not as tight as you could write it. You can edit it and make it a little bit better, but it's pretty darn tight. Again, the idea is not to just make it look right, because that would make it look right. The idea is to make it something that you can use in your own software. Right? That second goal hits you there, that it must be something that's programmable and that you can put in your own app. So it tries to minimize all that code and makes it efficient so that when you move it into your own app, you've kind of got the best you could do. Like if you were to hand-tune and hand-create that yourself, it tries to do that very thing.
Sure.
Which involves a lot of weird math. Some other things that it has to do is the coordinate space in Illustrator is flipped and reversed from what the canvas coordinate space is. So as you're starting, you start feeling like you're in this alternate universe.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, in a canvas, 0, 0 is up here and 0, 0 is down here when you're actually inside of Illustrator and its space. So you're getting coordinates that have to be transformed internally and even transformed a little bit more. Because one of the things that the plugin does is, if this is your artboard in Illustrator and you draw just a square, again, because you want this to be programmable, I probably don't want all this blank space that's on the page. I'd really like just the square. I'd want to trim it so it's just the square that gets output. So in addition to flipping coordinates, it also kind of repositions it logically so it's up here in the corner. It's where you'd want it if you were going to code against it. Not to belabor this point.
No, that's good to belabor.
You can really dive. It's kind of like diving into a portal and then to another portal.
Yeah.
If you watched Inception, the movie, it actually feels like that at times.
Nice.
If you put text on a page in Illustrator, you know, Mike, Charles, this coordinate space is even different again. Adobe has created this thing called the Adobe Text Engine that they've used across all their products. Great strategy. It's got a format that's unique to itself. So when you dive into those text coordinates, you've got to even do some more transformations. So it's a bunch of math. bunch of transformations, bunch of things like that.
Yeah.
And the goal is that you get efficient code, fast code,
sure,
that respects the artwork and looks like what it should look. Mm-hmm. So in most cases, you know, 80% plus clearly, mm-hmm, you're going to get out what you put in.
Excellent.
So that's the first challenge, was just to get the artwork out.
Yes, which is clearly a challenge.
It is.
And requires, you know, arguably probably too much computation, but you figure it out and it works.
That's right.
Which is beautiful.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to the next rabbit hole.
Yep.
But just quickly, you know, in this case, you're using native code because that's actually going to give you probably what?
So part of it is I don't have a choice, right? Because the Adobe Illustrator SDK, like Illustrator itself, is based on a lineage, a heritage of C and C++. So when you dive into the SDK, everything you do is either traditional, what I'll call traditional C or C++, some object-oriented concepts in there. Mm-hmm. So all of the code is written in C and C++. Yeah. And as a guy who's worked a bunch in managed code and have had to go back and forth, you know, it's a struggle to go back to an environment that isn't garbage collected.
But, I mean, let me ask you this. So, like you said, I mean, in some sense, it's definitely not garbage collected. In this case, it probably wouldn't help you unless you're using the generational garbage collector that's doing background collections. But at any rate, type safety, verifiability, that's important from the design phase. And, I mean, this is a tool, and I understand why that would also be useful. But in some sense, there's nothing wrong with using C to do this.
No, not at all.
Because you're doing a bunch of math.
The original version 4 months ago was pure C.
Nice.
But there happened to be a couple things in there that C++ would make easier for me, just from an architectural standpoint. Mm-hmm. So it got pulled forward to using quite a bit more C++ than it originally did. Mm-hmm. But at its core, because that's where I had stopped with the XAML exporter years ago, I started with basically a plain C where I was mallocing and, you know, getting rid of my own memory and doing all that management and that.
Agreed.
Some late nights trying to debug some of that.
And you know, not to belabor this point, but I mean, that certainly is one of the bummers of having to clean up. The way I look at it is programming, in some sense, is making a mess to make something beautiful.
Right.
And with managed code, the mess, for the most part, reliably gets cleaned up for you.
Correct.
And you focus on your art.
Correct.
In native code, you focus way too much time on, I mean, imagine making a sculpture, spending as much time making the sculpture as cleaning up all the crap.
Absolutely.
That it
produces. Absolutely. There's a lot of things that are liberating and freeing about managed code.
Absolutely.
The things that are just handled for you.
Yeah.
So.
But anyway, so that's very interesting. Uh-huh. Now let's get to the next.
Animation. I assume that's what you're talking about.
Totally.
Which is a big chunk that's. In fact, originally I didn't even expect there would be animation. That was one of those, huh, I wonder if you could, you know, and then now it's turned into something that actually does quite a bit of animation.
Well, and it should.
And it absolutely should.
Or you could have done what you said you could do. You wouldn't even need this tool. You'd say, take this and convert it to a JPEG or something else,
absolutely,
and I'll throw it on my web page in an image tab.
Absolutely. So, because as I erase this, because Canvas is really just a bitmap. Remember, at the end of the day, it's pixels on a screen. Well, I guess anything's pixels on a screen, but in this case, there is no retained object model. So if you want to do animation on a canvas, there's no built-in way really to do it. You can't say move this thing from here to there or rotate this thing over time. That concept isn't built into Canvas itself. That spec doesn't have it. So what you basically have to do is what you do is if you were going to build a game nowadays, like a casual game, is you draw a frame the way you want it to look using whatever commands you want to use, erase all or part of that frame and draw it all again with things in new places, mm-hmm, and just repeat, you know, rinse and repeat and do this over and over again as fast as you can do it. I was actually shocked that animated.
It worked
as well,
quite well
as it did, honestly.
It worked quite well, man.
Seriously, that was a surprise for me. So a couple things about animation. Animation, kind of by implication, is some sort of motion or change over time, right? That's what we observe, and that's what happens. And the way you coordinate all of that in a generic fashion has a lot of history, of course, and how this has been done in the past. And then you kind of take what history has done and apply it to something that's easy to understand, easy to code, and easy to work with in JavaScript, since that's the lingua franca of what we're talking about here, in HTML5. So the plugin itself assumes that there is a animation support library that it writes for you. It's actually pretty short, considering what it does. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you could actually rip it out and probably put your own version in if you wanted to. But it comes with an implementation in a JavaScript file. It's probably 15K at most, mm-hmm, not even minimized, with a bunch of comments so people understand what's going on. Mm. As soon as you introduce animation into the document, it automatically adds a line that includes this JavaScript file. And in the JavaScript file, it's all exposed, of course. You can go figure out a lot of these concepts. But there's this concept of a time provider. And a time provider does kind of what the name sounds like. It provides the time, right? So a clock, a JavaScript clock, would be the default time provider.
Okay.
And if you look at the time provider that's built in, the standard one is just based on the clock that's in JavaScript. So whenever somebody asks it for the time, the current time, it just grabs the JavaScript clock and spits out the ticks.
Okay.
It's as you'd expect. And you might even say, well, why would you even need a time provider if all you're going to do is grab the current time? Mm. And the answer is when you want to debug.
Okay.
In debugging, and there's a debug mode for the plugin that the tutorial will illustrate, but in debugging, you might not want the animation to just start and play through. You may want to use your mouse to scrub back and forth through time mm-hmm. so that you can see how things relate to each other as you're debugging animations.
Absolutely.
So there's actually a second time provider called debug clock, which basically just takes your mouse input, and when you ask it for the time that comes back is wherever your mouse is on the screen, conceptually. Mm. And then the rest of the stack doesn't have to change. You can just replace the time provider, and all of a sudden you've got kind of a debuggable, scrubbable version of the animation.
Excellent.
So that's the first concept, and that's in the JavaScript file. And, of course, the plugin's aware of the JavaScript, so it can do the coordination. So there's a time provider, and then beneath that, there's these things that I just call animation clocks. And again, if you look in the JavaScript file, you'll see that it's in there. And the animation clock takes whatever the current time is and how much time has changed since it was last invoked, and then uses, you know, a bunch of algorithms to figure out where its value should be. Now, to use the simple example, most clocks go from 0 to 1, right? They
yes.
start out ticking at 0 and they end up at 1. But some of the things you configure the clock with, I'll give you one simple one, is how long should this animation clock run? In other words, how long do I want this animation to run? So if I was moving something from point A to point B and I wanted it to happen over 10 seconds, I'd say one of the configurable properties here is duration, and it's given in seconds, so I'd say 10 seconds.
Okay.
And there's a property in the plugin that will spit out the right code, but honestly, you could just open up the JavaScript code. It's readable enough that you can muck with the code right there and make some changes too. So if you basically say, I want to create this animation clock with a duration of 10 seconds, its job then is to spit out this nice 0 through 1 value over the course of 10 seconds. So it'll look at the current time, whether it's coming from a mouse or from the actual JavaScript clock. At the beginning of time, it's going to be 0. At the end of time, it will be 1.
Interesting.
Now, you can create you might use a clock like this for fading something, changing the alpha value of something. 0 is completely transparent. 1 is completely opaque. And if you wanted something to fade in over 10 seconds, this clock would work perfectly because it would start setting its alpha value at 0, and it'd end with an alpha value of 1, and it'd look like it faded in, essentially. If you want to fade it out, another property is, does this clock reverse? Mm-hmm. And it just fade out.
Nice.
And that's great for that. It's also good for scaling.
Yep.
Another type of clock, and it's another property, is what is my range? By default, it is 0 through 1. But for rotation, you can actually just set the number of radians you want it to go through, right? So it could be 0 to whatever the value might be, and it will just, you know, meter out a nice, consistent clock tick that you can then use to rotate things.
Nice.
So the essential idea is that you create these animation clocks through properties in the plugin, and you can create many. There's an alpha animation, so fading in and out, opacity. There is a rotation, so you can rotate and spin things around. There is a scale, so you can make things bigger or smaller. And then there's also a second class, which is its own little discussion if we want to get to it, and that's motion around complex paths. So I want to take my thing, which might be fading, it might be rotating, it might be still doing all these other things, but also I would like it to move along some path that I created.
Nice.
The nice thing is, each time you create one of those, it gets its own clock that does its own ticking. Now, if you think about this example of 0 through 1 across 10 seconds, it's linear, meaning that these values are going to change in a very linear, metered fashion from 0 to 1. So if you're watching this fade on the screen, it will appear to fade in and fade out at the exact same rate. As animators, visual animators, often you don't want that. You want to mimic something in the real world where it starts out really bright and it slowly and then very fast fades to 0. Mm. Right? You want to do some other kind of motion that's not linear. So what you can add to the bottom of this is what I call a timing function, or sometimes called an easing function. And the idea here is to take this nice linear clock that's just ticking regularly mm-hmm. and do something to it, right? And if I were to graph this kind of like this and say, here's my input values from 0 to 1, let's just say.
Okay.
And my output values are on this axis. The standard timing function, which is just a linear timing function, the default, basically says if you spit me a 0, input me a 0, I'm going to output a 0. So I start there. If you give me a 1, I'm going to output a 1. And matter of fact, if you output it, basically it's going to look like this. Whatever you give me, I'm going to give you the same value back.
Okay.
But you can change these timing functions, and it ships with, I think, 28 of Robert Penner's famous, well-known timing functions to control easing. And then I've added a handful of some others that are interesting. So what these can look like is it can start looking like little curves. One of them might look like this. So basically, if you kind of read this, it's, matter of fact, I don't know if my hand will do this, but I'll try to move in a linear fashion this way and match the value here. Mm-hmm. It'll start out very slowly, and then it will speed up near the end.
Sure.
So this hand starts slow, and it ends fast. Mm-hmm. And there's many different curves that are in there. You can plug those in, and then when you get out the other side is you've converted kind of linear time into some sort of eased time. And then with no other calculations, you can start applying that to your animation properties, and you get cool behaviors. So you can get balls that start fast and slow down as they come to a rolling stop, and other behaviors. So this stack is automatically built for you by the plugin, but it's also exposed in the JavaScript, so it's very toyable and playable. And there's a lot more properties on this clock that I'm talking about here that are easy to explore. The other thing that clocks do is they spit out events.
Mm. Makes sense.
Yep. So one is I just started. Another one is I just stopped. Another one is I restarted. I'm not going to remember them all, but they're things like this. What's happened to me, essentially?
Yeah.
Hey, world, this happened.
Yeah.
And by default, no one listens.
Okay.
Well, poor little boring clocks, no one's listening to them.
Yeah.
But you can, using the plugin, hook into those events. You say, well, why would I want to hook into those events? Here's an animation example where you might want to hook into those events. Let's just say this is my canvas, and what I'd like to happen is I draw a ball. I want the ball to move this direction over some period of time, using the clock idea I just talked about here. And then I'm going to have another ball sitting here, not moving at all. Mm-hmm. But when it hits it, I want this ball to maybe bounce off the wall. Right? So this is an example of where I would take advantage of this event.
Okay.
What I do is this is an animation clock. As the ball starts here, goes to its clock, and then the clock will say, I stopped. Well, that's the perfect time for this one to start. Mm. So in addition to events, there's also actions on each clock. And in this case, I would basically say, when this animation stops, this animation should start, right? So I can chain behaviors, which make much more complex behavior possible. In the combination of events and actions, so I'd say event plus an action. So when this happens, do this. I call a trigger. So you can set up unlimited numbers of triggers. And in this example, if you wanted a cue ball to hit 12 other pool balls, mm-hmm. you would basically tell each of those pool balls to wait or watch for that stopped event on the cue ball to fire. And then they'd all start their animation and bounce off in whatever directions you had basically planned for them.
Nice.
Yeah.
So one thing that comes to mind when you're talking about this, because you said events and streams of events. And
yes.
Is RX for JavaScript, so the reactive framework for JavaScript by Eric Meyer and group.
Totally.
That would be fun to check out.
Totally. There's actually a lot of experimentation and some practical examples of events, this concept of events. Mm-hmm. And right, DOM objects in the browser have events too, like when you click something.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's this concept of events. The problem is there's no consistent model for events. There is for the DOM, but as soon as you're writing your own JavaScript code and you create your own object called a clock and you want it to spit out events, mm-hmm. what kind of events should I use? Mm-hmm. Right, jQuery's got events.
Yes.
Right, and you could use jQuery. You could replace this clock implementation with a jQuery one, and it should work just fine.
Sure.
I just wanted to provide something that required no other frameworks. But yeah, totally programmable, pluggable, replaceable. Tons of comments in the code, so I think anyone could.
Amazing.
Man. Anyone could figure it out, and it all performs very well.
So apparently, yes.
Yeah, it runs well. Yeah, surprising. So the other piece is motion.
Okay.
Right, so we've talked about rotation, alpha, and scale, which all use basically what I just described here. Mm-hmm. But we haven't really talked about motion. I've alluded to it. Mm-hmm. So let me erase a bit here.
Go for it.
That whiteboard's no good.
We need to get you another whiteboard.
Yeah, I do need to order a new one, don't I? So motion. in my pool cue ball example, I had a ball that I wanted to go straight and just stop, you know, over here essentially. Linear motion, I might want to add one of those timing functions so it'd move fast and then slow down and stop rolling, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's just a straight line. Most people don't want to animate things just along straight lines. They want more complicated motion than that. So, for example, if I wanted a... here we go. What if I had a path that looked like this, and I wanted a graphic image of a pen to actually follow along that path so it looked like it was writing that word?
Yes.
That might be an animation that you want to do.
Yep.
Clearly, there's very few straight lines. Well, I guess there's a few, but you can imagine scripted versions of this that aren't straight. So... the first question was, how do I add this to Illustrator?
Yes.
Illustrator is great at drawing paths and manipulating paths, but again, no idea what animation is. So Illustrator is built using layers, and we saw in that piece of artwork there was just one layer that had lots of art in it. But you can create many layers, as many as you'd like, and you can think of them like transparencies that you've drawn on. So the bottom layer, you've painted some things on, then you layer another transparency that's got some more artwork but obscures some of the stuff below, and as you stack them up, you kind of get an image. That's really how it works. So what you can do, what I decided to do is, because Illustrator is so good at drawing these shapes and curves and things like that, I will, one of those properties you can set on a layer was, for example, the rotation value or something like that. Is a property called rotate. I think I actually wrote it on there. Rotate direction, you know, clockwise, and there's a whole list of properties I can add to this kind of a layer. But there's a second kind of layer.
Okay.
If you don't tell it otherwise, it'll just be a drawing layer like we just saw. But if you want a path, a motion path, you create a new layer, and there's a property actually called type. Its default is drawing, which is why I didn't have to indicate it here because I just wanted to draw something. But you can actually create one called animation.
Nice.
And actually, I probably should have called it animation path to be more clear. But the idea is that I want this layer to not be drawn, but in fact, I want to use its artwork as only a path that I can follow.
Interesting.
Right? So I can draw whatever I want. I am not limited. But at the end of the day, use all these paths, this complex artwork, as an animation path. And you can set a lot of the other values that I was just talking about. So you can set a duration. Right? If I've got this crazy path like this, how long should it take to get from here to here? So I could say duration, 10 seconds again. There's a bunch of other properties. Actually, they're the same properties that I was just telling you about on that animation clock, because it just is an animation clock. But it's a new class of layer that basically is a special kind. And then what I can do in this layer is if this is the drawing I wanted to move along this path, there's actually a property called animate, colon, and then whatever I've named this layer, like if I named this layer path, I'd just say path.
Nice.
So draw this, do all the rotation, do all the alpha, do all the other stuff, and oh, while you're at it, move it along this path I've given you here. And you can do as much of this as you'd like, so you can make things that are pretty complex.
Excellent.
Now we get into the challenge of, how do you move something along a path like this? Because that's not as trivial as even I thought it would be. And it all comes down to the curve, and the definition of the curve. So in Illustrator, they use cubic Bezier curves, very common in computer artwork.
Okay.
And if you've ever drawn in a vector-based package, you've seen where I can kind of create this anchor point, I can create another anchor point, and then I can create these control points somewhere off in space. Matter of fact, usually there's a little line that's drawn on the screen. And the curve that's actually drawn starts at this anchor point to kind of, think of these as having gravity. It moves towards them, so it will move towards the first one, but also go towards the second one, and then end up at the second one. Right, and you can drag these handles all over the place to make crazy shapes. And matter of fact, most paths that are drawn in Illustrator will then have another anchor point with its own control points. So you can make whatever shape you want.
Okay.
Everything can end up being one of these. Even a straight line can end up being this, a control point here and here. And then when you plot it, it's just a straight line.
Sure.
Everything can go down to a Bezier curve. And in this case, a cubic Bezier curve, which has four inputs, cubic. And the four inputs are these points. And it's a well-known function. Matter of fact, if you pop open the JavaScript file, you'll see it in there. You basically pass it these values, and it'll tell you the return value. But if you pass it a value from 0 to 1, which is what it takes, works well with that animation clock, by the way. If I say, you know, calculate the position at 0, it's going to be on this anchor point. Calculate the position at 1, it's going to be back there. At 0.5, in this case, it probably will be there. For stranger curves, it might not be there.
Hmm.
And this is kind of getting to the core of the problem. So if I step through 0 to 1 at not super fine grain increments, but I jump a bit, the way this would plot would be I'd start out very fast, and then I'd slow down. I'm exaggerating here, and I'd end up very fast. And you can do that in a fine grain fashion, and you can draw a nice curve. But if you want to animate along that curve, you got a problem. Because depending on the shape of your curve now, if I'm just giving you a linear time, tick, 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 from 0 to 1, I'm going to start out, because the way this thing works, fast, slow down, and speed up. It's great if that's what you want, but in most cases, you probably want to do something else. So there's this category, the phrase is arc length parameterization. And the idea is if I give you a point in time, like we were talking about earlier, a point in linear time, let's put it that way. If I give you a point in linear time, doesn't matter where it is, I need to compute, just with that piece of information alone, where you would be if you were moving at a linear speed, a constant speed along this curve. So what arc length does is it refers to these lengths of the arc, right? So maybe the first one is, tell you what, I'm liking black markers too much, let's do blue.
Okay.
So let's say the first one is there. But the way I want to make this computation happen is it's based on the length of the arc. So it'd kind of be like if I got in my car and drove along this curve, and every X units I dropped a little marker, right? So you know, it'd look like this. I'm not going to get it exactly, but that would basically, that'd be a nice linear kind of signposts along this curve. But those values now need to be mapped to these other values within these ranges, right? So that when I get a clock that tells me I'm at 0.5, I can look across this index of points, these signposts, I know exactly where I'm going to be because it's an array that is linear, which means I can jump immediately to the value. And then once I've found a range, like I know it's in this range here, right? Then you can do some interpolation, which isn't very hard to do, that will basically figure out, in this case I'm right in the middle, so it's actually going to interpolate it right there. It will then figure out that the value that I really am looking for along this curve is whatever that value happens to be, and then the rest of it just works normally.
Nice.
So this idea of arc length, the parameterization part is actually the creation of these, I'll call them signposts, that you calculate, the plugin calculates for you, actually puts them into the JavaScript. A lot of times this is hidden away in animation packages, but in this case, there's an array of all these values right in there.
Nice.
So if somebody comes up with a better way to do any of this, it's there. Or honestly, if you just wanted this for some other purpose even, it's an easy way to get that data. And I've given you the simple example here, but remember, like I told you, almost anything you draw in Illustrator is going to have another one of these.
Exactly.
Right? And then another one of these. And the goal isn't just to be linear over the top of one of these curves. The goal is to be linear across all of these curves, right? To do this essentially along the whole path. And depending on the parameters of this cubic Bezier, the way I map 0 to 1 here is going to be very different than 0 to 1 maps here. So it's this whole idea, again, of diving into inception.
Mm-hmm.
You're in this frame of reference. Oh, wait, now you're in this other frame of reference. Yes. There's one more, is exactly how this works. But the good thing is after you've done the hard part, and the plugin and the JavaScript does the hard part for you, once you've got a way to basically do linear motion along this path, now you can add those easing functions again. So the start fast, slow down kind of stuff I was talking about works just like it does if my clock was taking things out in a very regular fashion. So, yeah, it does all this for you and spits it all out. And again, the nice thing is it's exposed.
Yes.
So if this stuff's been hidden in the past because it's been buried in an animation framework, it's not buried anymore. It's right out there for people to see and use.
So one of the questions I have, would be when you go from essentially you're doing translation, language translation, right?
Yes.
So you're computing in one language, your output is another language. This is a great example of JavaScript as, in some sense, a byte code, or basically an IL for the web. And so essentially you're compiling out JavaScript.
Yeah.
So my question to you would be, what kind of pitfalls did you experience? What did you learn about JavaScript that maybe you wish it would have done differently? That's just the
question. So I'll rewind a little bit and just give you my kind of, Mike Swanson walking up to JavaScript is, as an old coder in the early days of the web, my JavaScript was limited to, when this thing's clicked, do this thing. You didn't write any real software or code because at the time, years and years ago, the implementations were different, the performance wasn't that good, and it wasn't very rich language. But working on this project, I've had to learn a lot more about JavaScript than I ever knew. Matter of fact, I would highly recommend for anyone who really wants to know what's going on to go read the ECMAScript, the actual standard. Go find the standard. Go read that standard. Mm-hmm. And because I have a stack of, I don't know, 3 or 4 JavaScript books that I've bought just for this project to make sure that I'm doing things right.
Yes.
Because the risk is I'm kind of new to the new stuff. I don't want to do it wrong.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's improvements that can be made. But I've got this stack of 4 or 5 JavaScript books. And you know what? Reading the spec told me everything I ever needed to know in any of those other books. Now, it's not as, you know, you can't just cozy up to it maybe like the other 4 or 5 books. but if you take the time to think it through and read it through,
yes,
there's lots of insights into that language that as a guy who comes from more of a C background, C#, C++ background, mm-hmm. things I wouldn't have expected. Some liberating things about the JavaScript language, I'd even say. Like the ability to, so let me back up. If you dig into JavaScript or you watch one of the other great Channel N videos, I watched just a couple weekends ago,
cool.
where we talk about what JavaScript is and kind of behind the scenes, mm-hmm. one of the things that was a light bulb moment for me is that an object in JavaScript is really just like a property bag. It's some key that has some value. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I mean, there's more detail, of course, but
sure.
at its essence, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And then when you learn that functions themselves are also objects in JavaScript, and because I can set any other object to have a key and a value, and that value can be an object, I can actually set a function as one of the values of another object.
Hmm.
And the mind goes crazy when you think about all the things.
Sounds
you
like
can
functional
do.
Programming.
Sounds like functional programming, which wasn't my background. So this
sure.
is these are new concepts to me. And as a guy who was living and breathing C and C++ and then jumping in to debug the JavaScript, there were many times when I was looking at the very C-like syntax of JavaScript. You know, my brain just didn't grok it. Mm. But it is liberating to be able to take. I'll tell you one great example.
Good, excellent.
You got me thinking about one that was a very practical and useful example. Matter of fact, initially I wasn't sure whether I should do it, like it was illegal or some cop was going to stop me.
Mm.
But in fact, the language allows it and even encourages it. So when you name one of those layers, let's go back to a layer in Illustrator. And I'll call it, the tutorial. If you look at the tutorial, it actually has a rocket ship as one of its shapes.
Okay.
And I renamed the layer in the tutorial to just rocket, just like a JavaScript function.
Okay.
Well, when you do the file and the export and you go investigate the JavaScript, it actually creates a function called rocket. And what gets passed in is the context of the canvas, so it knows where it's supposed to draw its rocket ship. That's what that is. And then if you do your braces down here, these are all canvas drawing commands that are context dot, you know, move to X and Y, you know, and all the drawing commands that basically draw the rocket ship. So, and this is the form that's used. And the idea, again, is that you can copy this out, paste it into your own, grab your own context, pass it in, and you got your rocket ship.
Nice.
But when you start adding the animation, I started saying, okay, well, where do you put the values, right? Where do the animation values go for this rocket ship? And initially, there was a bunch of other structures and complexity that was put in until I realized something about JavaScript, and that is that this is an object, right? It can be thought of as an object. Mm-hmm. And because I can walk up to any object and assign it a new property and value, I can
yes.
just start sticking stuff on this rocket.
Yes, you can.
So, I love your enthusiasm, Charles. So in the initialization function for the page for the rocket, there are things like rocket dot x, which is where it is in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I just set rocket dot x to, I think I initialize it to 0,
mm-hmm.
right? And it changes based on animation clocks. And x is actually becomes a part of this, but I never reference it in here. I use it for other data that is related to the rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, initially that felt really wrong to me, but it's very liberating once you start embracing JavaScript. It's a very powerful language,
yes.
much more powerful than I thought. There are some nooks and crannies
mm-hmm.
That maybe you shouldn't go down. And then,
sure.
what is it? Douglas Crockford, I think, has the book on kind of the good parts of JavaScript
yes,
and some parts that you can avoid. That's an excellent book.
Yeah.
I'd highly recommend that. Not that you should never use those other things, but there's diminishing returns in this area. There'll be dragons down there,
yes.
so focus on the good parts. But when you focus on the good parts, you can do some amazing stuff. I'm seriously impressed with it.
Absolutely.
I'm also impressed with the performance across browsers, but
yeah.
certainly in IE9, since
yeah.
I've been spending a lot of time with IE9.
Cool. Well,
by the way,
yes,
this exports code that is HTML5 canvas compliant across major browsers. So
sure.
it works the same in IE9,
mm-hmm.
And the latest version is the beta, as of us recording this.
Mm-hmm.
It works with the latest version of Opera. It works with the latest version of Firefox, Chrome, and Safari.
Great.
So you spit this thing out, and you right-click and open it in any of those browsers, you're going to get the same behavior. They perform a little differently. They each have their own pluses and minuses. But at the end of the day, it's the same code. It's the same markup running the same way across all the browsers. I was actually pleasantly surprised at the level of consistency across the Canvas implementations across these browsers. Because I pretty much memorized the spec working on this.
Sure.
Because it uses almost every feature of the spec, actually, because Illustrator is so complex. And I was very pleasantly surprised at the level of support.
Excellent. And, of course, you experienced the cross-platform or cross-browser JavaScript implementations, which aren't really necessarily related to the HTML stuff.
Correct.
Explicitly.
Yep.
And one of the things I'd be curious of, you learned about in the Channel 9 video, I'm sure you also watched the video we did with Lars Bak on how he essentially implemented the Google Chrome engine, which is super fast.
Yep.
We're catching up. We're very close. Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, because...
I want to sneak one thing about performance.
Sneak it in.
What I want to sneak in is, at least in the examples that I'm talking about, what I've found is... JavaScript is now fast enough for this scenario across the major browsers that, for me at least in this plugin, it isn't the limiting factor. The limiting factor really is how fast can you erase canvases and splat and draw new pixels out on that screen, which is where you really start to see the discrepancy. Now, I know I'm an evangelist at Microsoft and I'm sounding like I'm a big, you know, IE9 hardware accelerated message right now.
Yeah.
But in fact, the reality is if anyone just downloads it and does this, you'll be surprised at how well IE9 renders stuff because it's offloaded so much of that work to the hardware. Yes. And I know other browsers are looking at the same thing, and that's great because it just makes it better for everybody. But the takeaway for me was the JavaScript in this case isn't the limiting factor.
It's incredible.
Yeah,
because,
it's very incredible.
Because the sheer amount.
Yes.
I mean, back in the day, like you said, JavaScript wasn't designed to be 20,000 lines of code.
Right. You wouldn't write an app in JavaScript. You'd just decorate your page with some JavaScript.
But now you are.
Yeah, you
and
can
now
write
you
apps.
Will.
Yes, you will.
Very interesting.
Yes, you will.
Let me ask you a quick question. I mean, is there... of course, the wrong thing to do would be to write a native plugin that only runs in one browser that actually interoperates with the canvas at the native level. At the DOM level.
I'm looking confused just because that would be a strange...
Why would you want... That would be a terrible thing to do,
and
it would not be cross-browser compliant, but I wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, not that you couldn't do it. I don't know why you'd do it, because that sounds a little weird, but...
Because then you could only write C++.
You know the best thing about software is people use software in surprising ways. Like, ways you never anticipated them using it.
Yes.
And that's the beauty.
This is great, Michael. I think, you know, people are obviously going to watch your tutorial. This video is for people to understand the thinking behind the thinking,
which I
think we've done a pretty good job of here.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're going to get a bunch of feedback and questions from the community.
I hope to. This is a first stab.
Yes.
Right? And I expect we worked with a lot of, if you looked at beautytheweb.com, the site that launched with all the HTML5 apps, early versions of this plugin helped a lot of those guys actually build out what they were able to ship on that day. So
nice.
We've got some feedback from some real shipping code, and we've got some other people who have been doing some really testing. But there aren't, you know, it's still a new format. Mm-hmm. There aren't any tools. A lot of people are just walking up to this now.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get practical feedback because people haven't used it yet in a lot of really practical ways. But that's ramping up really fast.
Totally.
So absolutely want the feedback to see where we can take this, see what improvements we could make. And there's already a list of things we'd love to do kind of in the next version.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like we've got a cohesive set of functionality that enables just a lot of stuff.
Sure.
In the first version.
And it doesn't sound like you're taking advantage of CSS.
No CSS.
Because that would help you with your drop shadow and your issue you were talking about, wouldn't it?
It wouldn't. Because once you're in Canvas world, you're in that bitmap, you're using commands that draw specifically and paint pixels specifically to that bitmap.
Got it.
So CSS doesn't, I won't say it doesn't have any place there, because there are some places there, but that's not the default behavior when you're painting on a canvas.
Excellent. And that's why it's called canvas.
That's why it's called canvas.
Hey,
blink!
Always great to talk to you, Michael.
Good to talk to you, too.
Yet again, a rocket ship, rocket science. Nice job, man.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Cool. And we'll talk to you again probably in a few years.
That's right. Probably in a few years. See
Cheers.
You.